mountains, deserts and streams. The rise of Dos Cabezas and the outlaws I see in my dreams.
This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading from Arizona Highways. William Hafford is the author of this article entitled Terminal Velocity. We all know what they say about curiosity. It killed the cat. In this particular case, curiosity only scared the daylights out of me and in a circuitous fashion introduced me to Paul Jordan, Arizona's test driver of runaway trucks. Jordan is a totally different type of guy. At least he's different from me. I have a distinct fear of falling from high places, fear of being out of control, fear of dangerously high speeds, fear of mutilation, and most decidedly, fear of leaving planet Earth before my appointed hour. Apparently, none of this stuff bothers Jordan. At any rate, my involvement with Jordan starts with an idea I get while driving down the face of Echo Cliffs in north central Arizona. I'm returning to Phoenix from Lake Powell. About 20 miles south of Page, U.S. Route 89 slips through a deep red rock cut, whips around a gooseneck curve, and starts a hairpin downhill dive toward the plateau country below. The view is spectacular and the road comfortably wide, but all that stands between me and a 1,000-foot drop is a metal guardrail. The sensation of being precariously perched is intensified by the incredible sweep of the countryside below. Down there, the highway appears as a meandering thread. I negotiate another curve, and then there's the sign, Runaway Truck Ramp, 2 miles. I've seen signs like that for years on some of Arizona's most threatening downhill inclines, but today the sign raises a question. What would it be like racing out of control down a steep, looping mountain incline with tons of cargo behind you and 18 screaming wheels beneath your rig? I decided to find out. My vehicle is a four-wheel drive with a sleeping bag and toothbrush for cargo. But what the heck? I slip the gear into neutral and take my foot off the brake pedal. At once, the pull of gravity grips me. As I round the first curve, the muscles in my arms flex. My heart starts a fast climb toward my throat. Suddenly, I'm out of the curve and into a straight stretch. But about 300 yards away, the asphalt disappears around another curve. I'm picking up speed. The argument between my foot and my brain is over fast. Foot leaps to the pedal and starts a rhythmic tippy-tap. The speedometer needle falls and I slide the gear shift back into drive. That was not a good idea. I glanced off the edge of the cliff. Far below and just off the highway is the runaway truck ramp. It looks like an airplane carrier deck in a sea of sand and sagebrush. The original question proliferates. How fast are the out-of-control trucks forced to use them? And how safe is it to drive 40 brakeless tons of cargo into that deep bed of gravel? A few days later, I'm talking to Dennis M. Duffy, an associate professor of civil engineering at Arizona State University. For nearly 2 years, he and his partner John F. Zanuski, also an associate professor of civil engineering at ASU, have been conducting studies on runaway ramps for the Arizona Department of Transportation. Their job is to assess the effectiveness of ramp construction and to provide recommendations for future designs. During their tests, they employ a special device that uses radio waves to measure truck velocity and rate of slowing. The whole idea behind the truck ramps, Duffy tells me, is to provide the driver with a way to ease his truck to a gradual stop while keeping the load safely constrained. The design consists of an entry ramp, then an arrestor bed of deep gravel, usually about 1,200 feet long, and an access apron alongside the bed so a large towing vehicle can get close enough to pull the truck out. What causes runaway trucks, I inquire. Brake failure, says Duffy. Generally, the driver misjudges the incline and doesn't properly downshift. The brakes can't take it. They burn out. Sometimes a coincidental mechanical failure complicates the problem. How fast are they going when they enter? Back in 89, we calculated speed on a rig that went in with a combined tractor and cargo weight of more than 80,000 pounds. We estimated entry at well over 100 miles per hour. The load stayed intact and the driver sustained no injuries. Just down the road from that particular ramp, there is a fairly busy junction. While my mind conjures up some gruesome possibilities, the function of the ramp takes on added importance. For your tests, I asked, how do you simulate a truck going into the runaway ramp? We put Paul Jordan in a rental truck and he rides it down the mountain in an out-of-control condition. He's a partner in Jimbo's Truck Repair and Towing Service in Camp Verde. John Januski, our graduate students, and I have done the tests with him. Duffy says that previously there had been little research on runaway truck ramp use. When we started to do full-scale testing, I called over 100 trucking companies trying to find one that would supply us with a truck and a driver. I finally found one, and they said they'd give it a try. Duffy and a driver named Murphy did the initial testing, but the trucking company decided it didn't want to use its trucks that way. Then this thought hit me, he says. Jordan, who had been driving the tow truck during that first series of tests, seemed like a pretty savvy individual with heavy equipment. I asked him, and he said, no problem. He's been our test driver ever since. A few days later, I'm sitting on a sofa in Jordan's bachelor digs on the outskirts of Camp Verde. All of the tests have been videotaped, and he is slipping a cartridge into the VCR. Jordan is 48, but he looks about a dozen years younger. He wears metal-rimmed glasses and a deep tan. His hair is Top Gun tousled, and he is dressed in blue jeans and a tight T-shirt. I ask him if being a trucking test driver is a scary business. No, he replies. Don't you ever feel that your life is in danger? No. He smiles. Do you have moments of concern? No. He's still smiling. I've already determined that Jordan is a totally personable guy. He runs a successful business, and Duffy says he's sharp as a tack. But I have some doubt about his nonchalant reaction to those wild downhill rides. The video begins. In the far background, the truck with Jordan at the wheel emerges at the base of a precipitous canyon, getting bigger fast. During the test, other vehicles are being held back by the highway patrol. Suddenly, the truck veers out of the lane and whips into the ramp entry. How fast? I inquire. About 65, he replies. Abruptly, the rig hits the gravel bed, starts crow-hopping and fishtailing, throwing up a giant spray of gravel and dust. Finally, after about 700 feet, it comes to a stop. It's only a videotape I'm watching, but the effect is enough to wake the butterflies in my stomach. On screen, the door opens and Jordan jumps to the ground through a cloud of settling dust. He flashes a white-toothed grin and gives the thumbs-up sign. No doubt about it, Paul Jordan likes his job. Do you want to watch another, he asks. How many runs do you do? 14 that day, he tells me. I think I've done about 95 test runs since spring. Jordan talks while the video runs. On one run, when he follows the tracks of a previous test, there is a passenger in the cab with a handheld camera. When the truck hits the gravel bed, the camera goes wild, flying from Paul's face to the dashboard, to the ceiling, to the floor. That shows you why you need to keep yourself harnessed in when you hit the gravel, Jordan tells me. Some truck drivers think they might need to jump, so they take off their seatbelts. That'll bruise a man up real bad. Besides, you need to be strapped down so you can hang onto that steering wheel. How often do trucks use the ramps? I've dragged as high as 7 a month out of the southbound ramp on Interstate 17 just up the road. They're not all commercial rigs, Jordan tells me. People moving their household goods in rental trucks sometimes lose their brakes. Passenger cars? No, generally they're not packing enough weight to burn their brakes. But a couple of times I've been called out to tow folks who thought the ramp was a roadside picnic area. I asked one man if he hadn't seen the big signs that said runaway truck ramp. He replied he didn't know what that meant, and besides, the place looked like a picnic area. He was up to his frame in gravel and not too happy about it. Do you think the ramps are a significant factor in highway safety? Jordan grows pensive for a moment. No truck driver I've ever pulled out of an escape ramp has been hurt enough to go to the hospital. I've also pulled many a livestock truck out of those gravel beds, and I've never seen an animal truly injured. But coming down State Route 260, where there isn't an escape ramp, A cattle truck lost its brakes and wrecked. All the animals in the trailer were either dead or so badly hurt that they had to be done away with. He pauses for a moment. Now change those cattle to people and put them on a tour bus with no brakes. The phone rings. Jordan mostly listens, then says, "I'm on my way." He turns toward me as he hangs up. 18-wheeler ran off the highway near Cordis Junction and is sitting out in a rancher's pasture. As I'm tossing tape recorder and briefcase into my vehicle, Jordan makes me an offer. "Next time we do some test runs, I'll give you a call. Let you take a ride with me." I thank him and shake his hand. "Actually," I say, "the videotapes gave me a real good feel for what it's like." "No," he tells me, "you need to take an actual ride. That's where the fun is." "I'm out of town a lot, hard to find sometimes," I say. "I'll keep trying until I get you." He waves as I turn my truck toward the gate. The main problem is that Jordan is too nice a guy to turn down. Maybe he will keep trying until he gets me. As I pull onto the highway, I'm thinking of one of those 24-hour answering services, the kind that screens your calls around the clock. Maybe that's what I need. And this concludes Terminal Velocity. The next article is entitled Hualapai Mountain, Camouflaged by Forbidding Terrain, a little-known county park nestled in a high-rise oasis among the pines, rich in scenery, solitude, and wildlife, and all just minutes from civilization. For 2 decades, I avoided the Hualapai Mountains. 2 or 3 times a year, I'd drive by on the way to Kingman or Laughlin, Nevada, past the winter snow tops and summer heat shimmers. It's just too inhospitable, I thought, for casual acquaintance. So I felt silly to discover a tame 12 miles of paved road leading south from Kingman into the heart of the highest peaks to a network of trails, campgrounds, and rental cabins built in the 1930s by dollar-a-day Civilian Conservation Corps labor and where elk and deer come in evenings to drink. On a summer morning, I climbed 8,239-foot Aspen Peak, the third highest of 3 summits in Hualapai Mountain Park. Only Hualapai and Hayden Peaks at 8,417 feet and 8,390 feet top Aspen. In an otherwise buckskinned colored land where giant boulders were stacked like bleached bones to form a 3-pointed coronet sky island of tall timber and wildflower parks, this alpine uplift in a stunted desert provides a surprise a minute. Here on the mountaintop, a swarm of red dragonflies, 3 inches long, hundreds of them, more than I've seen anywhere before, wing past me. Why they gathered above the nearest surface water, at least a half mile away and 2,000 feet down, remains a mystery to me. Dragonflies, relics of the dinosaur age, need water to breed. I take a seat, certain I will not see anything like this again. Below spread juniper hills that always look thirsty, and beyond, a folded desert forms the Hualapai Escarpment extending to Burrow Creek, 40 miles to the south. The north side of the Hualapais shears abruptly, ending in grassland on Kingman's outskirts. Like I said, it's an awful-looking place from afar, but close up, Hualapai Mountain Park shelters a rich ecosystem that thrives in temperatures 15 degrees Fahrenheit cooler than the lowlands, and is just a short drive from supermarkets and gas pumps. Normally, I camp under the stars. For a change, I had checked into the privately owned Hualapai Mountain Lodge, occupying the site of the former CCC camp headquarters. On a weekday in early July, prime season, only one other room was taken. Night would bring blanket temperatures. Owner Elaine Jeffrey was glad for the guests. "This place is a well-kept secret, considering it's been here a very long time," she said. "Kingman residents driving up to beat the heat are her usual customers. Change may be coming," I learned from Mojave County Park Ranger George Toten. With a bigger Lake Havasu City and with nearby Bullhead City growing along with the casinos along the Colorado River in Nevada, park use is up, reports Toten. "You've got a better chance at a cabin during the week," he advises, referring to the county-owned facilities at the park. Mojave County rents 15 cabins, including a bunkhouse that sleeps 10, and it collects fees at the ranger station for the cabins, full-service recreation vehicle camp, and tent campground. The cabins of native rock and clapboard were built 60 years ago for CCC laborers, and staying in them is like camping indoors, said Toten with a grin. You have to bring everything with you, including your bedding. Despite the no-frills arrangements, right now, for a cabin on a Sunday night, you'd need to reserve 10 weeks in advance. From the gatehouse, Toten hands out free park maps, which show 6.5 miles of maintained hiking trails, plus other trails that are unmaintained by the county. There's also a horse path. A 5-car parking area marks the start of Aspen Springs Trail, which leads to all the others in the 2,262-acre park. After the dragonfly show, I'm ready for new trails. Returning to the ponderosa and white fir forest below the wind-polished knob of Aspen Peak, I continue on, eventually passing a miner's old potato garden before I arrive at his gold mine. Along the way, I birdwatch. More than 75 species of birds are reported in the Hualapais, including the uncommon lazuli bunting. Hawks command the high places, owls terrorize the night, and a flock of turkey vultures picks up the pieces. Through a spotting scope, I count 24 vultures jockeying for dominance in the pine snag before they disperse at sundown. I also glass for elk and deer. A bold mule deer buck walked up to the lodge, and Margaret Moorbeck told me, "We have lots of elk. Moorbeck owns a bed and breakfast inn beside Pine Lake, a half-acre dammed pond. Pond regulars," she said, "include 3 elk bulls. I notice flower beds and saplings armor-plated behind wire mesh enclosures. The elk eat everything," she said, explaining the need for protection. "It's difficult to have fruit and vegetables here." Like a granite knuckle, Hualapai Peak looms over the Moorbeck Pond and the 157 private homes and cabins of Pine Lake Village. No trail leads up. So sure am I that's where the elk are, I set my course in that direction and run into Scoutmaster Todd Becker of Kingman and 300 Boy Scouts midway through a week-long encampment. "The Scout Lodge is under siege," Becker says. 4 or 5 skunks came walking through last night." I get the picture. The Hualapais are home to both spotted and striped skunks. Both species are aggressive raiders. I make a mental note to hang food high whenever I tent camp in these mountains. A real estate appraiser, Becker, confirms more desert people and out-of-state visitors now come in summer to the Hualapais. It's the only place for miles where you can breathe pine-scented air. The road is open to the park in all weather, but there are good months and bad ones. Winter hushes the high peaks, driving out the songbirds. Snow can hug the high ground for days. About 24 to 30 inches of precipitation fall annually above 6,000 feet, mostly occurring between October and May. "My brother lives up here in the village," Becker says. "He'll drive in with this much snow on his car." He gestures about 4 inches, and it won't even have rained in town. Winter is short, and spring brings wildflowers. Botanists list more than 100 species of trees and plants, including the white-blossomed Apache plume and fennler bush and pink cliff roses. Toward autumn, black walnut trees shed their iron-clad fruit, and groves of quaking aspen turn golden and tremble in the frosty air. Summer is best, from May to September, with pleasantly warm days and cool nights, and an occasional rain shower to help recharge the groundwater wells that supply the mountain people. Apparently, 19th-century miner W.H. Shoulders found enough water to grow spuds at 7,000 feet in the red dirt inner basin concealed by the circle of peaks. His unlikely garden enterprise gives the place its name, Potato Patch. The main trail splits there, with the Potato Patch Loop doubling back to the trailhead and Hayden Peak West Trail continuing on across Shoulders' old potato ground through Ponderosa to a saddle between Hualapai and Hayden Peaks. That's the way I head. 2 hawks flush from an old-growth pine, wings noisily sucking at the air to gain altitude away from me. There's elk scat, and I think I may be getting close, and I quickly discover Shoulders' trace. He lived in a cabin near his mine, climbing to tend his spuds. A fire escape route sign on the ridge marks the probable location where his trail topped out. Pushing my way through scrub oak thickets that draw blood, I clanged down a ravine toward a dirt road a half mile away. Shoulder's cabin is gone, but the 1878 American flag mine, worked after the Hualapa Indians were banished from the mountains, still attracts the curious. An angle iron barrier keeps them out. Just as well, too, because the mine is dangerous, with two flooded vertical shafts that steadily leak icy water, a commodity more precious in the desert than gold. Mine seepage forms puddles in the road. Elk and deer water here, tracks show, but not me. I take a pull of tepid canteen water, wary of possible lead or mercury that may be coming from the mine, and move on. My map shows a graded road ambles 30 miles through high desert, mostly overseen by the Bureau of Land Management, past wild cow campground, more abandoned gold mines, and across the Wapayuma Peak Wilderness area, and then on to Yucca Flats on Interstate 40, heading to Los Angeles. The road in the other direction traverses the midriff of Hualapai Peak, the upper slopes cast in the midday shadows, where I still hope to see an elk. Finally, I come full circle back to Moorbeck's Pond. No elk and no red dragonflies either. I find Herman Dale Coger, 59, of Kingman instead. They say Coger has the best job around. He digs around the village with his backhoe. Afternoon, he goes fishing or looking for gold. You can always find him afternoons down at the pond, I was told. Right on schedule, Coger flicked a rubber jug into the dark pond water. I've caught a pound and a half bluegill, and my best was a 3-pound bass, he says. They're likely still there, too. The Moorbecks require all fish be thrown back. Coger gets to catch them again and again. When they're not biting, Coger pokes around old Hualapai mines for overlooked color. There really ain't much to be found, he says. Oh, yeah? A lot of gold and also silver has been dug in the Hualapais. Miners sought enough of the prospects to have the Hualapai Indians driven out by the U.S. Army in the 1860s. Hardly anybody cared about the recreation potential of the Hualapais until the CCC camp opened in August 1936 to put 200 Americans to work during the Depression. The first thing they did was cut a decent road into the mountains. By the 1950s, however, almost everyone except local residents forgot about the place. It's being discovered again. Nevertheless, you can still find plenty of solitude left in the woods and be the only climber on the mountain, and you can still find room at the inn. To get to Hualapai Mountain Park from Phoenix, take U.S. Route 93 to Interstate 40 from points east and west, I-40 to Kingman. Leave the freeway at Andy Devine Boulevard, then take Hualapai Mountain Road. To reserve a cabin or campsite, call the Mojave County Parks Department at 928-757-0915. And this concludes Hualapai Mountain. I'll conclude today's readings with a little Arizona humor. During the heat of summer, I took my two young daughters to Canyon Lake for a day of fun and swimming. We splashed and played for so long that no amount of sunscreen could shield them from the effects of the desert sun. Soon they resembled a cup of boiled Maine lobsters. The girls stayed indoors for the next week and each received a daily slathering of aloe vera gel. Despite our efforts, my youngest came to me crying one day and said, "Mommy, I think I'm sick. My skin is falling off." My older daughter laughed and said, "You're not sick. You're just part rattlesnake." That was submitted by Betty Cousins of Mesa. Kate Holmes of Florence writes, "An airline pilot told me that on one particular Phoenix landing, he hammered his plane onto the runway really hard. The airline had a policy that required him to stand at the door while the passengers exited, smile, and give them a 'thank you for flying XYZ airline.' He said that in light of his bad landing, he had a difficult time looking the passengers in the eye. Finally, everyone had gotten off except for a little old lady with a cane. She walked up to him, leaned on her cane, and asked, 'Did we land or were we shot down?'" That concludes today's readings from Arizona Highways. This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
I love you Arizona. Your mountains, deserts, and streams rise of Dos Cabezas. And the outlaws I see in my dreams love you, Arizona.
If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Log on to sunsounds.org, left click on broadcast info and audio, then under programming links, left click on demand podcasts. In addition, you can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.